age. Not a nice man. I finished the sherry and went inside. The murmur of voices in the little red room continued. I thought then that really the longer they talked, the better. Every minute that passed could bind them closer to each other, and also would use up more of the dangerous time. When they got hungry, they might come out, but more likely they were too agitated to feel hunger. In spite of my fears, I was not. I sat for a while eating biscuits and olives. Then I scraped the remains of the kedgeree onto a plate and took it outside again, together with a glass of white wine, and resumed my sea view. I felt very odd, excited, nervous, a bit drunk, but clear in the head. Almost at once, however, I heard Titus shouting. He evidently could not bring himself to shout either Charles or Mr. Araby, but called out several times, "Hello there," followed by various urgent owl hoots. I considered ignoring these cries, but decided I had better not, even though it was far too early to expect Ben. I returned precariously to the lawn with my plate and glass. Titus and Hartley were standing outside by the door, she wearing that distraught, frightened look which I now knew so well. Titus said, "Look, Mary thinks she'd better go. I've told her there's lots of time, but she wants to go now, okay?" Hartley said, "Could I have the car at once, please?" She spoke in a hard, almost angry tone. Titus said, "I looked out front. I couldn't see it. She's getting very bothered." "Nothing to bother about," I said. I went into the kitchen and they followed me. "Won't you have some supper?"
"I must go," said Hartley.
Her moment, whatever it had been, with Titus was now over, and the cruel husband-dominated time whose slave she was had driven even Titus out of her head. The old panic was back. How I detested that fierce, almost relentless look of fear upon her face. It made her ugly. While in the wood, when she kissed my hand, she had looked beautiful. Titus said, "Come on, where's the car? She's got to go home." Titus had evidently forgotten that his task was to keep Hartley at Shrough End. Or more likely, he had been infected by her fear. I had been too tactful in my explanations to Titus. Too vague. I had not told him everything that I had in mind, partly because I did not know how he would react. I had told him that my idea was that Hartley would want to stay, and that he should add his persuasions. But I now saw that I ought to have been more explicit. "There's no need to go," I said.
"I've stayed much longer than I meant to already," said Hartley. "He said he'd be back about 9:30, but he could be sooner. So please, I must go now, this very minute."
"There's no need to. I've sent Opian round with a note saying you're here with Titus, so he won't worry, he'll come here. Then Gilbert can run you all back." Titus whistled. He saw at once the enormity of what I had done. Hartley was a moment taking it in.
You mean you've told him? Deliberately told him? Oh, you wicked! Oh, you fool! You don't know! You don't know!"
Tears of rage and despair sprang into her eyes, and her face blazed at me. I stepped back. I said, pursuing the role that I had adopted, but also speaking sincerely, "Hartley, you mustn't be so frightened of him. I'm absolutely fed up with your attitude to that bloody man. Why should you feel you have to lie to him all the time? Why the hell shouldn't you be here with Titus? It's perfectly natural and proper." Titus looked at Hartley with interested concern, and at me quizzically.
"And did you invite him here?" "Jesus," he added.
"Of course he won't have seen the letter yet because he won't be home." Hartley, looking at her watch, had just realized this too.
"Oh, yes, he mustn't see it. He mustn't see it. If we go at once, there'll be time to get it before he sees it. Then everything will be all right. He just mustn't see the letter. Please, we must go at once. The car! The car!"
I said, with a maddening air of calm, "I'm terribly sorry. But the car isn't there. It's gone on to the garage by the Raven Hotel. There's a fault in the engine."
"When will it be back?" said Titus.
"I don't know. Oh, soon, I dare say."
"We could ring them up."
"I haven't got a telephone."
Hartley cried, "I must go, I must go, I must go. If I run, I can get there in time."
"I'll run for you," said Titus. "No, you won't," I said, glaring at him. "Now, Hartley, do Just sit down here at the table and stop behaving like a mad person. The car will probably be back any moment. But listen, I don't want you to go back there, back to him, back to his house. I want you to stay here with Titus and me. I gave Titus another meaningful look. I felt as if I were sifting the sense into her head. Hartley sat down. She looked from me to Titus and back, like a frightened animal. I sat down beside her. She was trembling, and I saw some dawning of understanding in her terrified eyes. There was a sudden atmosphere of crisis. Titus said, "She wants to go back, and I'll go back with her. I've decided to." I said, still trying to gain time, "No, no, both of you stay here. Hartley, my dear, he'll know where you are. He won't think you've drowned. He can come and see Titus here. Titus stays here. He lives here. Titus, you don't really want to go over there, do you?" Titus, visibly distressed, said again, "She wants to go back. She doesn't want him to see the letter. There's still time. I could run over there in 20 minutes. It's just beyond the village, isn't it?" "Oh, go, please, please," cried Hartley. "Go now. The door isn't locked. You can just—" "Or should I run to the hotel, which is nearer?" I said to Titus, "I want him to see the letter, and you are both to stay here. Are we that man's slaves? I want to let your mother out of that cage." Hartley gave a cry of woe. "Why do you want him to see the letter?" said Titus. "I don't understand all this. It's like some sort of plot. I know you said you hoped she'd want to see me here and that, but I didn't think you meant to pull the whole bag of tricks down on her head." "That is exactly what I do want to do," I said, "to pull the whole bag of tricks down on her head."
"No, no,"
Hartley leapt up and made a dash for the door. I blundered after her and, reaching for her shoulder, grabbed the neck of the dress, which tore a little. When she felt it tear, she stopped. Then she came back to the table and sat down with her face in her hands. Titus said, "Look, I don't like this. You can't keep her here against her will. I want her to be able to decide freely."
"Freely? She can't," said Titus. "She's forgotten about freedom long ago. Besides, if you keep her here, she'll be far too frightened to think. You don't know what this is like. She might go mad."
"I'm afraid I misunderstood. You didn't say so, but I thought you had some sort of understanding with her. I thought she was sort of prepared. But you can't suddenly make someone leave someone they've lived with for years."
"Why not?
When people do leave people they've lived with for years, they usually do it suddenly, because that's the only possible way. I'm helping her to do what she really wants to do, but without help can't. Isn't that clear?"
"Not awfully. She'll calm down. She'll be able to think soon, tomorrow."
"Tomorrow? Here?"
"Yes."
"You're going to keep her all night?"
"Yes."
"Suppose he comes?"
"I don't think he will. To answer your earlier question, I did not invite him."
"Oh, Jesus. What'll he think?"
"I don't care a fuck what he thinks," I said. "In fact, the worse he thinks, the better. Let him think anything his foul imagination can beget."
"That's part of pulling everything down?"
"Yes."
"My God," said Titus. Then he said, "I think it's obscene. And I don't like this talking about her as if she were a child or mental patient. I'm going to swim."
"Titus, don't think too ill of me.
You see—" "Oh, I don't think ill of you. In a way, I'm quite breathless with admiration. I just couldn't do it myself.
You're not going to run over there for the letter?"
"No. I expect it's too late anyway." "And you won't run away from me?"
"I won't run away from you."
He went out of the back door. Outside, it was a hazier, later evening, and the shadows of the rocks were long, long on the grass. I did not look at my watch. I sat down beside Hartley. She had taken her hands from her face and was sitting limp, staring at the table. Where I had dragged at her dress, there was a little triangular tear. I could see the deep, reddish streak of sunburn that led downward from her throat. I could see her brassiere and the roundness of her contained breasts, the quick, almost panting movement of her breath. It was indeed obscene. I had, from the inception of this plan in my mind, intended to keep Hartley here, by force if necessary, but I had not imagined the details, and I had somehow hoped that as soon as she saw Titus in my house, she would make the great mental leap, the intuition, the necessary conjecture.
She would see her freedom, and the possibility of living with Titus and me. And once she had grasped her freedom, I had the strong and reasonable hope that she would come to me, even though Titus was an unknown quantity and had his own freedom to dispose of. But perhaps I had indeed, inspired by the boy's providential appearance, tried to move too fast. The horrors of the last half hour had shaken my resolution so that I nearly conceived of, after all, taking her home. Yet could I? Now? He was almost certainly back, and had read that letter, and my plan had succeeded so well that it had trapped me also. I did now look at my watch. It was 9:25. I took her hands, and put them neatly one on top of the other, and my hand above them. Then I turned her face round to look at me. She had not been crying. To my unspeakable relief, I received not the harsh, anxious glare that I so much dreaded, but a new quiet look, gentle and reflective. And although she looked so sad, yet she seemed younger, more like her old self, and also more alive, less apathetic, more intelligent. My confidence returned. Perhaps, after all, her freedom was stirring. Perhaps my plan had been right. It was a question of a cure, a psychological cure, and in the instant I decided that it would now be fatal to show any weakness. I must be absolute. I must be to the full the being who had made Titus breathless with admiration. "I'm not going to let you go, Hartley. Not tonight. Not ever. You can't go back tonight, anyway. It's too late to get that letter. He's got it now. Let him think what he pleases. Why should you fear him and lie to him? That hurts me so. I can't bear it. Titus can't bear it. Titus wants you, but he doesn't want him. Doesn't that suggest anything to your mind? I like Titus. Titus likes me. Why shouldn't Titus be my son? Why shouldn't you be my wife? It's fate, Hartley. It's fate. Why should Titus turn up just now? Why should he come to me? Why should I be here at all? You must see how extraordinarily it's all worked out. Titus so much wanted to be with you, but he would never have gone over there, never. And you were glad to see him, weren't you? And you were able to talk to him. What did you talk about? The dogs. The dogs. He was remembering the dogs we had when he was little. He likes animals. Oh, good. Hartley, just relax. Let it go. Let it drop. Let what drop? You know, this burden, this useless, fruitless loyalty, this pointless sacrifice. You're making his life a misery, too. Let it go. Let him go. You're like a half-dead person. Yes, she said thoughtfully. I've felt half-dead, yes, often. I think quite a lot of people do. But you can live on half-dead and even have pleasures in your life. The reflective tone of her voice made me want to sing out with joy. I was reaching her. She was speaking of it, of it. I was waking up my sleeping princess. You must be hungry. Have some wine. Have some kedgeree. There's a bit left. I'll just have some wine. And some of that bread. And cheese. And olives. I don't like olives. I told you before. She ate a few mouthfuls of bread and cheese, then thrust it aside. She drank some wine. I drank a little, too. I could not eat. Hartley, do you know? I think you've crossed the Rubicon. And what's on the other side? Freedom. Happiness. Something has certainly happened, she said, and she gave me her calmer face, deliberately smoothing out her brow with her hand. Then she smoothed her cheeks, moulding her face and making it calm and open. There was a capability, a capacity there which heartened me. I saw again the way her wildness was also a kind of serenity. But it's not what you think. It isn't anything to do with happiness. I'm not going to struggle with you, dear Charles. I mean to struggle physically, to try to rush away, and to weep and scream when I can't, though that is just what I'm doing now in my mind, weeping and screaming. There are moments, I've learnt, when one has to fold one's hands. I can see what you want to do and why. You want to make my marriage crash, explode. But it won't. It's indestructible.
You speak as if it were a prison.
people live in prisons.
Not if they can get out.
Then, too, sometimes. But, oh, you don't understand. You can only make things worse. And you have done so tonight.
Her words, her tone, now sounded terrible, like a calm judge pronouncing a fatal sentence. Yet I thought, if she desperately, absolutely wanted to go, she would weep and scream, and could reasonably believe that this would make me give in. So, since she was, though tragically, calm, she must be a little bit glad to be forced to stay. No doubt her feelings were wretchedly mixed, positively minced up. It was getting a little darker in the kitchen now. Titus came in through the outside door and went over to the stove. He did not look at us. He found the plate with the remains of the kedgeree. I was suddenly reminded of Gilbert, who would still be at his post outside. I called after Titus, who was disappearing into the hall with the kedgeree. "Go and tell Gilbert to come in. He's up by the tower with the car. Then lock the front door." I gave her some more wine. There was now something almost alarming about her resigned quietness. Did she expect I would suddenly take her home after all? Perhaps it was her dread of just this prospect which made her so quiet. I did not immediately follow up what she said. I got up and locked the outside door and pocketed the key. I was faintly sure Ben would not turn up tonight. I was feeling so strong now that I hardly cared whether he did or not. I heard Gilbert coming in, complaining loudly to Titus, and I heard the key turn in the front door. I lit a candle and pulled the curtains, although it was still light outside, with a huge, dull moon the colour of Wensleydale cheese. It was the first time I had been with Hartley without an urgent time limit. The sense of solitude with her, of the extension of time, was uncanny. I felt both exultant and unreal. I drank some more wine. "Hartley, I don't think I've been perfectly happy at all since you went away. You can't conceive how I suffered then. But we were happy, weren't we? When we were on our bikes? That was youth, like it ought to be, joyous, perfect. I've never loved anybody else. That is why, really, you must excuse me if I now go to some lengths." I adopted a light tone, hoping to entice her into some gentleness of response. And I thought, oh God, if only I'd found her during the war. If only I'd run into her in the street in Leicester. And with the speed of the cinema-reeling imagination, I saw how I might have met her, how she would have told me her marriage was a failure, or better still, Ben would already have met a hero's death, and I even got as far as composing my explanation to Clement, before Hartley spoke again. "You think it's odd I'm so quiet. It's like a sort of peace. Sometimes I feel I haven't much further to go." "What do you mean by that?"
"Sometimes I wish he would..."
"Would what? Has he threatened you?"
"No, no. That wasn't what I was going to say."
"What do you mean, then?" "Look, you can't go back to him. I won't let you, even if you don't want to stay with me."
But what did I think I would do then? Set her up in a flower shop?
"Hartley, you've got to stay with me and Titus. It's your place. Apart from anything else, Titus having come to me will confirm Ben's idea that he is my son."
"Have you only just thought of that?"
"Oh, Hartley, darling, be gentle with me. Don't be so sort of remote. Admit it. Say it. You've never really loved anybody but me. You've come home at last.
That night, when I saw you in the car headlights, you had come here. You had to come. Say that you love me. Say that it will be all right, that we'll be happy.
Christ, don't you want to be happy at last and live with a man who loves you and is kind to you and believes what you say?
Hartley, look at me. No, come in here. I don't know why we're sitting at this stupid table."
I picked up the candle and pulled her into the little red room and drew the curtains. I sat in the armchair and wanted to take her on my knee, but she slipped to the floor at my feet and held on to my hand. I began very slowly and carefully to kiss her, then to caress her breasts. We were like children, adolescents. I felt for her
a desire which was marvellously indistinguishable from pure love, reverent, strong, consumingly protective. And my desire was also that of a boy, incompetent, unskilled, and humble. I did not know how to hold her, or how to make her dry lips respond. Finally I got down on the floor too, manoeuvred her to lie full length beside me, and clasped her, peering awkwardly into her face. "Hartley, you love me, don't you? Don't you?" "Oh, yes. But what does it mean?"
"We're close. We know each other."
"Yes, it's strange. But in a way I do know you. And there isn't anyone else who's near me like that. I suppose it's just because we were young, and later you can't know people. Or I couldn't."
"You know me. I know you."
I've felt as if I didn't exist. As if I were invisible. Miles away from the world. Miles away. You can't imagine how much alone I've been all my life. It wasn't anybody's fault. It was my fault.
"I can see you, Hartley. You exist. You're here.
I love you. Titus loves you. We'll all be together."
"Titus stopped loving me long ago."
"Don't cry. He loves you. I know he does. He told me so. All will be well now that you've got away from that hateful man."
I kept touching the quiet tears upon her cheek, and at last, half thrusting me away, she began to caress my face.
"Oh, Charles, Charles, so strange."
"We're like we used to be, lying in the woods.
Hartley, will you be with me tonight, please, at last, just to be together, quietly? We don't have to lie here like this all night, do we?"
She became rigid, then sat up.
"It's the wine. I'm not used to it. I must be drunk. Drunk.
Well, don't ask me to take you back now. It's much too late, from every possible point of view." She got to her knees, then stiffly to her feet. I rose and faced her, gently touching her elbows with my fingertips.
"Charles, you don't know what you've done. Of course I shall go back tomorrow. I must sleep now. I just want to sleep now, by myself. I wish I could die in my sleep. I wish I could run out and fall into the sea."
"What rubbish. Can you swim?"
"No."
"Let's go upstairs. Promise me you won't run away in the night."
"Tomorrow I must go back there. This is just more of my stupidity. Oh, I am so stupid, always stupid. I should never have left the house. I'm not angry with you. It's my fault. Everything is my fault. Yes, I suppose I love you. I've never forgotten you. And when I saw you, I felt it all again. But it's something childish. It isn't part of the real world. There was never any place for our love in the world. If there had been, it would have won, and we wouldn't have parted. It wasn't just me. It was you. You went away. You can't remember how it was. And there isn't any place for this love in the world now. It's pointless. It's irrelevant. It's a dream. We're in a dream place, and tomorrow we must leave it. You say it was fated. Perhaps it is, but not like you think. It's an evil fate. It's my fate. I made it happen somehow, this muddle, this horror. Why did you come here? I somehow made you come, like people allured to destruction, not for any good, but just for disaster and death. That's what I've been making all my life. Not a home, not a child, but just horrors."
I recalled Titus's words. "She's a bit of a fantasist." And no doubt she was indeed quite drunk. There was certainly no point in arguing now with the madness of her words. I hugged her hard. "Stop it, old thing, darling little Hartley. I did not go away from you, not like that. You know you're only making excuses. Our love will make its place in the world, you'll see. Now that you're here, it's all very simple, really. Just wait till the morning and the daylight, and then you'll feel brave. Come along upstairs with me, and you shall sleep where you like."
I led her out through the kitchen, carrying the candle. As we came to the stairs, I saw a faint light under the door of the front room where Titus was sleeping, and I heard the murmur of voices. At the thought of Titus and Gilbert, sitting on the floor on those cushions by candlelight, I felt a quick spasm of jealousy. Hartley and I went upstairs. I showed her the bathroom. I waited for her. I led her up and into my bedroom, but it was quite clear that she would not sleep with me. It was in any case better now to leave her alone. A kind of superstitious terror had taken hold of her, which took the form of a frenzied desire for unconsciousness. I want to sleep. I must sleep. Only sleep matters. Sleep. I will sleep.
I'd had the sense to anticipate this situation, and had made up a bed on the floor of the little center room upstairs with a mattress off my divan. I had also provided a candle, matches, even a chamber pot. I offered her a pair of pyjamas, but she lay down at once in her dress and pulled the blanket up over her head, as if she were a corpse covering itself. Now she did seem then to go to sleep instantly. The quick flight into oblivion of the chronically unhappy person. I withdrew and left her. I closed the door and quietly locked it on the outside. I would never now lose that nightmare image of a distraught woman rushing to drown herself in the sea. I went to my room and kicked my shoes off and crawled into bed. I was completely exhausted, but imagined I would be too excited to sleep. I was wrong. I was fast asleep in seconds. The next morning I woke to a sense of an utterly changed and perhaps dreadful world, like on the first day of a war. Joy, hope, came too, but fear first, and a black sense of confusion as if the deep logic of the universe had suddenly gone wrong. What was it that I had been so certain of, so confident about? What exactly was I up to? Had I done something mad and frightful yesterday, like a crime committed when drunk, remembered sober? There was also, to be expected, a visit from Ben. The presence of Hartley in the house was itself like a dream. Her sheer survival overnight now something urgently in question. I felt like a child who rushes to the cage of its new pet, fearing to find only a lifeless body. With a sick stomach and a pounding heart, I ran out into the corridor, beat my way through the bead curtain, softly unlocked her door, and tapped. No response. Had she died in the night, like a captured animal? Had she somehow escaped and drowned herself? I opened the door and peered in. She was there, and awake. She had pushed the pillows up against the wall and lay upon the mattress, with her head propped, the blanket pulled up over her mouth. Her eyes stared at me under drooped lids. Her head kept moving slightly, and I saw she was shivering. "Hartley, darling, are you all right? Did you sleep? Were you warm enough?" She lowered the blanket a little, and her mouth moved. "Hartley, you're going to stay with me forever. This is the first day of our new world, isn't it? Oh, Hartley." She began very awkwardly to pull herself up, leaning her back against the wall, still hiding behind the blanket. She said in a mumbling, gabbling tone, not looking at me, "I must go home." "Don't start that again. I came without my bag, without anything. I've got no makeup or anything. God, as if that mattered." I could see that, for her, it might matter, however. In the bleak, drained morning light which filtered in from the window which gave onto the drawing-room, she looked terrible. Her face was puffy and greasy, her brow corrugated, lines of haggardness outlined her mouth, her tangled hair, dry and frizzy, looked like an old wig. As I gazed at her, I felt a kind of new strength, composed of pity and tenderness. And as I thought to show her how little I minded her shabby helplessness, my titanic love could even have wished for greater odds. "Come on, old thing," I said. "Get up. Come on down and we'll have breakfast. Then I'll send Gilbert over to Niblett's for all your things. It's perfectly simple." Or at least I hoped it would seem so to her. She pulled herself up slowly, and then got onto all fours, and rose laboriously to her feet. Her yellow dress was horribly, hopelessly crumpled, and she pulled at it ineffectually. Her whole body expressed the slightly ashamed awkwardness of the very afflicted person. "Look, I'll lend you my dressing gown. I've got such a nice one." I ran to my bedroom and brought her my best black silk dressing gown with the red rosettes. She stood at the door of her room, staring at the bead curtain.
"What's that?"
"Well, you may ask. A bead curtain. Now put this on. There's the bathroom, you remember." She let me help her into the dressing gown, then walked slowly down to the bathroom. I waited, sitting on the stairs. When she emerged, she climbed back up, towards her room, moving heavily like an old woman. "Wait, then. I'll get you a comb, or you can come and use the mirror in my room. Would you like? It's brighter in there." She went on back into her own room. I fetched the comb and a hand mirror. She combed her hair, not looking into the glass, then sat down again on the mattress. There was indeed no other furniture, since the table which Titus had retrieved from the rocks was still downstairs. "Won't you come down?"
"No, I'll stay here."
"I'll bring you something.
I feel sick. The wine has made me sick.
Would you like tea? Coffee?"
"I feel sick."
She lay down again and pulled up the blanket. I looked at her with despair, then went out. I closed and locked the door. I did not exclude the possibility that after this show of apathy she might suddenly run for it, rushing out of the house and disappearing among the rocks, hurling herself into the sea. I went downstairs and found Gilbert sitting at the kitchen table. He rose respectfully as I entered. Titus was at the stove, which he had mastered, cooking eggs. He seemed now to be completely at home in the house. At this I felt both pleasure and displeasure.
"Morning, Governor," said Gilbert.
"Hello, Dad."
I did not care for this pleasantry from Titus. "If you must be familiar, my name is Charles."
"Sorry, Mr. Arabi."
"How is my mother this morning?"
"Oh, Titus, Titus. Have a fried egg," said Gilbert. "I'll take her up some tea. Does she take milk, sugar?"
"I can't remember."
I made up a little tray with tea, milk, and sugar, bread, butter, marmalade. I carried it up, balanced it, unlocked the door. Hartley was still lying under the blanket. "Lovely breakfast. Look." She stared at me with almost theatrical misery. "Wait, I'll get a table and chair." I ran downstairs and came back, with a little table and a chair. I unpacked the tray onto the table. "Come, darling, don't let your tea get cold. And look, I brought you such a lovely present. A stone. The most beautiful stone on the shore." I laid down beside her plate the elliptical stone, my very first one, the prize of my collection, hand-sized, a mottled pink, irregularly criss-crossed with white bars in a design before which Klee and Mondrian would have bowed to the ground. Hartley came slowly, crawling, then rising, and stood by the table, pulling the dressing gown round her. She did not look at the stone or touch it. I put my arms round her for a moment and kissed her wig-like hair. Then I kissed her warm, silk-clad shoulder. Then I left her and locked the door. At any rate, she had said no more about going back. No doubt she was afraid. And if she feared to think of returning now, then every hour which kept her here would help to gain my point. But her air of apathetic misery appalled me. Later I was not surprised to find that she had drunk a little tea, but eaten nothing. I looked at my watch. It was still not 8 o'clock. I wondered when and how Ben would arrive. I remembered uneasily what Hartley had said about his having kept his army revolver. I went down to the kitchen to issue orders. Gilbert was eating fried eggs, fried bread, grilled tomatoes. "Where's the boy?"
"He's gone to swim. How's Hartley?"
"Oh, terrible. I mean, all right. Listen, Gilbert, could you go outside and keep watch?"
"All right, finish your breakfast first. You're doing well, aren't you?"
"What do you mean, keep watch?" said Gilbert, suspiciously.
"Just stand, or if you like, sit on the road at the end of the causeway, and come in and tell me when you see him coming."
"How am I to know him? By his horsewhip?"
"He's unmistakable." I described Ben minutely.
"Suppose he creeps up on me or something. He can't be feeling very pleased."
You said he was a tough, sort of thug. I love you, darling, but I'm not going to fight.
Nobody is going to fight, I hope.
I don't mind sitting in the car, said Gilbert. I'll sit in the car with the doors locked and watch the road. Then if I see him, I'll hoot the horn.
This seemed a good idea. All right, but make it snappy. I went out of the back and across the grass and climbed over the rocks as far as the little cliff, in time to see Titus's long, pale legs elevated to heaven as he dived under the green water. It reminded me of Bruegel's Icarus, Absit Omen. I had not the heart to swim, and anyway I did not want Ben to find me trouserless, and there was enough of a swell on for me to see that I might have difficulty getting out. Titus would be all right, of course. I must remember to fix another rope at the steps. The sun was already high, and the sea was a lucid green nearer to the rocks, a glittering azure farther out, shifting and flashing as if large plates of white were floating on the surface. The horizon was a line of gold. A surge of rather large but very smooth, slow waves was coming in towards me and silently frothing up among the rocks. There was a quiet menace in the graceful, yet machine-like power of their strong, regular motions. I waited rather impatiently for young Titus to finish his swim. He had no business to be diverting himself at a moment of crisis. He saw me, waved, but was clearly in no hurry. He shouted to me to come in, but I shook my head. I urgently wanted Titus on the land, partly because I wanted to efface the rather raw impression of our stupid exchanges in the kitchen. Also, I wanted Titus beside me, clothed and efficient and in his right mind, when the gentleman turned up. I did not really imagine that Ben would come round and murder us all, but unless there was some show of strength, he might possibly wish to punch my head. And while I am athletic and fairly strong, the arts of aggression have never been among my accomplishments. I often wondered during the war how it was that men were able to face other men and kill them. Training helped, and I suppose fear. I was glad that it had not been my lot. It also then occurred to me, as I dourly watched Titus's dolphin antics, that I did not really know how he would react. He had fairly indicated that he detested his adoptive father, but the young mind is mysterious. Confronted with him, he might be cowed, or else moved by sudden sympathy, or by old, deep, resistless, filial emotions. Could Titus change sides? Did Titus himself know? At last he swam back to the steep rock and, clinging with fingers and toes, easily levered his naked body up out of the strong rising and falling surge. He crawled up, swung over the edge, and lay panting. "Titus, dear boy, get dressed, quick. Here's your towel." He obeyed, eyeing me. "What's the matter? Are we going somewhere?" "No, but I'm afraid your father may arrive any moment." "Looking for my mother? Well, I suppose he may. What will you do?" "I don't know. What will he do?" "Listen, Titus, and please forgive my clumsy haste, there's so much I want to say to you. Titus, we must hold on to each other, you and me."
"Oh, yes, I'm a very important property. I'm the decoy duck. I'm the hostage."
"No, this is exactly my point. This is what I came out here to say to you. Not for that, for you. I mean, I want you. I want to be your father. I want you to be my son, whatever happens. I mean, even if your mother won't stay with me, but I hope and believe she will, but even if she weren't to, I still want you to accept me as your father."
"It's a funny action," he said, "accepting somebody as your father when you're grown up. I'm not sure how it's done."
"Time will show us how it's done. You must just have the will, the intent. Please. I feel there is a real bond between us. It will grow stronger, naturally. Don't think I'm just using you. I'm not. I feel love for you. Excuse the clumsy awkwardness of what I say. I haven't time to think of a graceful speech. I feel that fate or God or something has given us to each other. Let us not stupidly miss this chance. Don't let idiotic pride or suspicion or failure of imagination or failure of hope spoil this thing for us. Let us now and henceforth belong together. Never mind what it means exactly or what it will involve. We can't see that yet. But will you accept? Will you try?"
I had not prepared or anticipated quite such passionate pleading. I stared at him anxiously, hoping I had made some impression. He was clothed by now, and we stood together on the high rock above the water. He looked at me, frowning and screwing up his eyes. Then he looked away.
All right, I suppose.
Yes. Okay.
I'm, in fact, well, a little overwhelmed, actually. I'm glad you said that about wanting me for me. I wasn't sure.
I believe you, I think.
It's funny. I've been thinking about you so much of my life, and I always knew I'd have to come and look at you one day, but I kept putting it off because I was afraid. I thought that if you rejected me, I mean, thought I was a sort of lying scrounger, just wanting money and that, and, well, why shouldn't you have thought so? It's all so odd. It would have been a sort of crippling blow. I can't see how I would have recovered. I'd have felt so dishonoured and awful. I'd have been saddled with it somehow forever after. There was so much at stake.
So much, yes. But all is well, here at least. We won't misunderstand each other. We won't lose each other. It's all happened so fast.
It's happened fast because it's right. It's easy because it's right.
Well, then, I'll try.
As you say, God knows what it means. But I accept. At least I'll try.
He held out his hand and I grasped it, and for a moment we stood there, moved and embarrassed. Then I heard from the roadway the loud, urgent hooting of Gilbert's horn.
That's him.
I jumped up and began to scramble towards the house. Titus passed me and raced on before me over the grass. When I reached the kitchen door, Gilbert was holding on to Titus.
He's here. He came walking along the road. He stopped at the causeway, but when he saw me in the car, and when I started hooting, he walked on.
Walked on past the house?
Yes. Maybe he's going to come round the back, over the rocks.
Gilbert seemed to be really frightened. I ran through the hall and out onto the causeway and up to the road. There was no sign of Ben. I noticed that Gilbert, no doubt to secure his own retreat, had parked the car right across the end of the causeway as if it were intended as a barricade. That, no doubt, was why Ben had walked on. As I was still hesitating and staring about, I heard Titus shouting from the other side of the house. I passed Gilbert, who was gabbling something or other at the door, and rushed out again through the kitchen. Titus was standing up on top of one of the highest rocks and pointing.
"He's there! There! I can see him! He's coming along from the tower!"
By now I felt no more doubt about whose side Titus was on. Thank goodness for that. I called to Titus, "You wait there. I'll go and meet him. If I want you, I'll shout." I began to climb over the rocks, keeping the tower in view, and in a moment I saw Ben, also clambering, with an impressive agility, in the direction of the house. The place where our two paths converged, and indeed the only fairly easy way from the house to the tower, was Min's Bridge, the rocky arch under which the sea entered the cauldron. Towards this natural meeting place we both scrambled and slid until we came onto the bridge and faced each other some 10 feet apart. I wondered quickly and a bit anxiously whether we were, as I hoped, still within the view of Titus upon his high rock. I looked quickly round. We were not. Ben was wearing blackish corduroy trousers, rubbed bald at the knees, probably from the fisherman's stores, and a white shirt. No jacket, though the morning was still chilly. Had he donned this stripped gear to assure me he was carrying no weapon? Or was he simply dressed for fighting? He looked burly, a bit tight for his trousers, but compact and businesslike. He appeared to have shaved, which I had not. He had shaved alone over there in that suddenly empty house with God knows what thoughts in his mind as he faced himself in the mirror. His cropped, mousy hair, his big boyish head, broad shoulders and short build were reminiscent of a little ram or other smallish but aggressive male animal. By contrast with his thick, heavy look, I felt positively willowy, loose, untidy, with uncombed hair, and, I suddenly realized, my striped pyjama jacket still on over my trousers. I advanced a little onto the bridge, and so did he. The tide was coming in, and the strong large waves were crowding in and washing hungrily round inside the deep, smooth space of the cauldron. There was a low, sibilant roar, not loud enough to impede a parley. I stood, checking on my pajama buttons and waiting for him to begin. The roaring sound comforted me. I hoped it disconcerted Ben. Noise has always been my friend. I was now seeing Ben's face closely in a good light for the first time. He was rather better looking than I had imagined earlier. He had long brown eyes with long lashes and a large, well-formed and, though perhaps only now, slightly sneering and fastidious mouth. His chin receded into his thick neck. I was at once aware that he was, and I was relieved to see it, extremely nervous, though also extremely angry. Was he perhaps a bit frightened of me? Guilt? Guilt makes fear.
"Where is my wife?"
"Here, in my house, where she wants to stay. And Titus, too. He wasn't my son, as you perfectly well know, but he is now. I've adopted him."
"What?"
"Yes."
"What did you say?"
I realized with further satisfaction that Ben was a bit deaf. Deafer than me, at any rate, and the noise was bothering him. I'd rather gabbled my statement, it is true. I said, with loud, insulting clarity, "She is here. Titus is here. They stay here.
I've come to take her home."
"Look, you don't really believe that Titus is my son, do you? I assure you he isn't."
"I want my wife."
"I'm telling you something that ought to interest you. Titus is not my son."
"I don't care about that story any more. It's over. I want Mary."
"She wants to stay here."
"I don't believe you. You're keeping her by force. You kidnapped her." "I know she wouldn't stay of her own free will. I know.
She came to me. She ran to me, like she did before, that evening when you were at your woodwork class. Do you imagine that I could or would remove her from your house by force?"
"She left her handbag behind."
"You don't love her. She doesn't love you. She's terrified of you. Why not admit it to yourselves? Why go on living this horrible lie?"
"Release Mary, or I shall go to the police."
"They'd laugh at you. You know quite well the police wouldn't interfere in a case of this sort."
"I want my wife."
"She doesn't want to go back to you. She's had enough. I'm going to send the car round for her things."
"What lies has she told you?"
"That's your line now, is it? Vilify her. Put the blame on her. How splendidly you give yourself away."
"She's a hysterical person who imagines a lot of things. She isn't well."
"She certainly imagines she's had enough of your cruelty. Go on. Just try the police. See what happens."
"You don't know what you're meddling with. You don't understand. She's my wife, and I love her, and I'm going to take her back to her home, where she belongs and where she wants to be. Why have you suddenly come interfering in our lives? Why did you decide to come and live here and pester us? We didn't want you." "We don't want you. I know what sort of person you are. I've read about you. You're a rotten man, a shit, a destroyer. You're filth. Mary isn't one of your show business whores. She's a decent woman, like you aren't worthy to touch. Leave us alone, if you don't want to get very hurt. I'm warning you. Leave us alone!"
Ben, incoherently searching for words to match his anger, his big bull head thrust forward, was showing his strong teeth, wet with spittle. The rhythmic hissing roar of the powerful mechanical waves entranced me for a moment, as without looking down I could sense their churning movement in the rocky pit below. I thought to myself quite clearly, with a precision which involved my whole body, I have only to step quickly forward and pitch that hateful thug over the edge. He may be stronger, but I am more agile. He cannot swim, and even a good swimmer would die at once in that boiling cauldron. No one sees us. I can say he attacked me. I have only to push him in, and all my troubles are over. As I thought this, I was fixing Ben with my eyes. I felt an embryonic movement of my body, though no doubt in reality I did not visibly stir. My eyes were enough, however, and I had the certainty that he had read my intention, if indeed it could be called an intention, for of course I would never have carried it out. He retreated to the far end of the bridge, and I unclenched my hands and lowered my eyes. I retreated, too.
"Bring her back!" he said, raising his voice, as the din of the water rose like a wall between us. "Bring her back this morning, or else I'll go every possible way to destroy you. I'm telling you, I mean that."
I said nothing. He said, as if suddenly confused and with a catch in his voice,
"Consider her! She wants to come home! I know she does! You don't understand. Don't let this go on. It's worse for her. She'll have to come home in the end, don't you see?"
I said, inaudibly, "Fuck off." He began to move away. Then he turned back and called out,
"Tell her I brought the dog back last night. I thought she'd be so pleased."
I watched him as, more slowly and seeming now at last like a cripple, he climbed over the rocks, appearing and disappearing, until he had nearly reached the road. I shook myself out of my trance and began to make my way back to the house as fast as I could. I wanted to be sure he was really going away. Titus, who was still sitting on his high rock, jumped up and followed. Gilbert was on the lawn. They both immediately started to question me, but I ran past them. They ran after me, and we emerged all three onto the causeway and advanced as far as Gilbert's car, which was still in position. We stood in a row behind the car. Ben was walking along the road towards us. Titus gazed at him for a moment, then turned round and stood there with his back to the road. The gesture was impressive. Ben passed us by, grim-faced, without a word, without a look, and walked onward, unhurried, in the direction of the village.
"What's happened?" said Titus, now looking shaken, frightened.
"Nothing."
"How nothing?"
"He said what he had to say."
"What did he say?"
"Lies. He said she was hysterical and imagined things."
"Hysterical, all right," said Titus. "She could be in hysterics for an hour. It was frightening. It was meant to be."
"If you've decided he's your father after all, you can go home with him now. I'm not stopping you."
"Don't talk to me like that. I'm just so bloody sorry for her."
"Won't you come up and see her?"
"No. Not while she's... no."
Oh. I felt violent, homicidal exasperation. I ran back into the house and up the stairs and unlocked Hartley's door. She was sitting on the mattress with her back against the wall and her knees up, draped in a black dressing gown. She looked at me with heavy, swollen eyes and started speaking in a droning voice before I was through the door.
"Please let me go home. I want to go home. I've got to go there. There isn't anywhere else to go. Let me go home, please."
"This is home. With me is home. You are home.
Let me go now. How can you be so unkind to me? The longer I stay, the worse it will be."
"Why do you want to go back to that hateful place? Are you hypnotized or what?"
"I wish I was dead. I think I'm going to die soon. I feel it. Sometimes I felt I would die by wishing it when I went to sleep, but I always woke up again and found I was still there. Every morning, finding I'm still me. That's hell."
"Well, get out of hell, then. The gate's open, and I'm holding it."
"I can't. I'm hell myself."
"Oh, Hartley, get up. Come on down and sit in the sun. Talk to me. Talk to Titus. You're not a prisoner. Stop being so bloody miserable. You'll drive me mad. I'm offering you freedom, happiness. I want to take you and Titus to Paris, to Athens, to New York, anywhere you want to go.
I want to go home."
"What's the matter with you? You weren't like this yesterday."
"I think I'm going to die. I feel it."
Her eyes, which refused to meet mine, had the defensive coldness of those who are determined to lose hope. There followed some of the strangest days I can ever remember. Hartley refused to come downstairs. She stayed hid in her room like a sick animal. I locked her door in case she should drown herself. I left her no candle and matches in case she should burn herself. I feared for her safety and her well-being at every moment, and yet I did not dare to remain with her all the time, or even most of it. Indeed, I scarcely knew how to be with her at all. I left her alone at night, and the nights were long as she retired early, and slept soon. I could hear her snoring. She spent a great deal of time sleeping, both in the night and in the afternoon. That oblivion, at least, was her prompt friend. Meanwhile, I watched and waited,
calculating upon some deep, unstatable theory the right intervals for my appearances. I escorted her in silence to the bathroom. I spent long vigils sitting outside in the corridor. I put some cushions into the empty alcove, the place where I had dreamt there was a secret door through which Mrs. Chawney would emerge to reclaim possession of her house. I sat on the cushions, watching the door of Hartley's room and listening. Sometimes, as she snored, I dozed. Of course, I often sat in the room with her, talking with her, or attempting to, or else in silence. I knelt beside her, stroking her hands and her hair, and caressing her as one might caress a small bird. Her legs and feet were bare, but she would persist in wearing my dressing gown over her dress. Yet with small contacts, I made acquaintance, surreptitiously, with her body. The weight and mass of it, her magnificent round breasts, her plump shoulders, her thighs. And I would gladly have lain with her, only she resisted, by the slightest of signs, my slightest of efforts to undress her. She fretted about having no make-up, and I sent Gilbert to the village to purchase what she wanted, and then in my presence she made up her face. This little concession to vanity seemed to me a hopeful portent, but I remained afraid of her and for her. My quiet, relentless refusal to let her go was violence enough. I feared that any further pressure might produce some frenzy of hostility, or some more extreme withdrawal which would render me as mad as she was— for I did at moments think of her as mad. Thus we existed together in a sort of crazy, mysterious, precarious, mutual toleration. At intervals she repeated that she wanted to go home, but she accepted my firm refusals passively, and this was encouraging. Of course, with every hour that passed, her fear of returning must increase, and this in itself gave me hope. Surely a moment must come when the amount of her fear would automatically make her mine. We did, in fact, inconsequentially and at odd intervals, manage to converse. When I tried to remind her of old times, she did not always fail to respond, and at moments in my treatment of her I felt, loving her and pitying her so intensely, that I was making a little progress. Once, quite out of the blue, she asked, "What happened to Aunt Estelle?" I could not remember having spoken to her about Aunt Estelle, so much had I made my uncle's family into a taboo subject. Another time she said, "Philip never liked you." Philip was her brother. "What's Philip doing now?"
"He was killed in the war," she added. "You were my brother, really."
She never asked me anything about my life in the theatre, and I did not try to tell her anything. I think she was really without curiosity about it. It had in any case by now dawned on me that she felt little or no regret at having failed to marry a famous man. She did ask once or twice if I had met this or that well-known actor, but she clearly knew very little about the theatre and did not pursue anything that I said. Once she asked, "Did you ever know an actress called Clement Makin?" After a moment's reflection, I said, "Yes, I knew her well. She loved me. We lived together for a bit."
"You mean—"
"She was my mistress."
"But she must have been years and years older than you."
"Yes, but that didn't seem to matter much."
"She must have been an old woman."
A little while after this, Hartley began to cry, and let me put my arms round her. She did not speak of Clement again. That was one of the moments when hope itself seemed to come to me out of the pity and the love, and I reflected upon the mystery that Hartley had as large a consciousness and as long a history as I had myself, and I would never know, never have access to, that interior being. Of course I was impatient. I had expected her, after despair, to be in such need that she would have to turn to me completely, having no other recourse. It was indeed her failure to break down that now left me so terribly at a loss. Herein I did expect Titus to help me, but he was unwilling to, perhaps unable to. He seemed almost frightened of Hartley, frightened of her situation, her captivity, her awful helplessness, what he imagined of her mind. He hated her humiliation. He did not want to be involved in it. He seemed to feel about the whole business, my device or game, as he had called it, a mixture of disgust and complicit guilt. And no doubt, at least vicariously, he was afraid of Ben. He complained of the smell in Hartley's room and said he could not breathe there,